Ah, postpartum brain fog. Did you even know that was a thing? But I'm guessing that if you have little ones at home, you're probably feeling it, along with the increased mental load of trying to be a multitasking caregiver, facing the stressful demands of everyday life. And that's without even considering the added lack of sleep. It's definitely a lot, which is why I'm so appreciative of Needed's cognitive support supplement, created to help support key aspects of cognitive health like focus and attention, brain health and memory, and even alleviate brain fog and eye fatigue. Now, what makes Needed's cognitive support so unique is that, unlike many other cognitive support supplements, Needed's is appropriate to take while breastfeeding. In fact, it was designed with this in mind. But don't just take my word for it. In an in-market study, 92% of people taking Needed's cognitive support saw an improvement in overall cognitive function, with 78% seeing an improvement in mental clarity, aka brain fog. And of these many positive reviews, my favorite is one that says, quote, "This is my third postpartum period. This is the best I have felt mentally and physically, despite now having 3 kiddos to care for," end quote. Basically, taking Needed's cognitive support is an easy way to help reclaim your brain during postpartum. Head over to thisisneeded.com and use the code BIRTHFUL for 20% off your first month of Needed products. That's thisisneeded.com and use the code BIRTHFUL for 20% off your first month of Needed products. Postpartum body odor. It is a totally natural phenomenon because your body chemistry changes after giving birth. And so sometimes that means that what worked before is no longer effective. But I am excited to say that now there is a solution for that stubborn odor. The Sugar Sugar Postpartum Deodorant is a completely natural deodorant made by a postpartum mom who went through it herself, and it works by eliminating and preventing bacterial body odor without covering up your skin's comforting smell to your baby while giving you 12 hours of odor control. And let me tell you, it actually works. Here at the house, we've all been trying it and loving it. Now, before you think, ew, you're sharing a deodorant with your husband and daughter, let me explain that this full body deodorant comes in a convenient pump applicator that lets you apply it anywhere on your body with no bacteria traveling on the deodorant, so no ew involved. We also love that the Sugar Sugar Postpartum Deodorant has a delightful natural scent of USDA certified organic extracts that smell like a pink sugar cookie with lemon frosting. I thought this would be a little strange, but it's actually amazing. Also, the Sugar Sugar Postpartum Deodorant is free from artificial fragrances and any kind of senoestrogens or herbs that can interfere with breastfeeding. Find your Sugar Sugar Postpartum Deodorant at postpartumdeodorant.com. That's postpartumdeodorant.com and use the code BIRTHFUL for 20% off through the month of May. Get your Sugar Sugar Postpartum Deodorant now at postpartumdeodorant.com and start smelling more like yourself again. Hey, Mighty One. With nearly 300 BIRTHFUL episodes in over 5 years, it may be hard to know where to begin listening to the show. To make it easier, we've put together the Best of BIRTHFUL series, which showcases some of our favorite or most relevant episodes. This is one of those. If you enjoy what you hear, make sure you subscribe. It's free, and that way you won't miss a thing. Enjoy. Hello, mighty parents and parents-to-be. Thank you, as always, for all the love you give the show and your feedback. I have the immense pleasure of talking with Kristen Pascucci, who is the founder of Birth Monopoly, where she advocates for a freer maternity care market, working closely with leading national advocates, organizations, and birth lawyers, as well as educating the public and healthcare providers about women's human and legal rights in childbirth. Welcome, Kristen.
Thank you.
So we're talking today about informed consent in childbirth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things related to that. Let's start right at the bit. Like, what does that even mean?
Informed consent is one of our most basic rights in our healthcare. it's sort of rooted in the idea that each of us owns our own bodies, which, you know, sounds really simple and sort of, you know, sort of basic, but it means a lot in, especially in maternity care. So informed consent is the process by which a healthcare provider informs a patient about the risks and benefits and alternatives to anything that they're suggesting, and then gets the free, non-coerced consent of the patient to perform that procedure or, you know, whatever it is. And that also includes the right of refusal, which is really important. That's the right to say no to anything that has to do with your body. So this is really critical in maternity care because just the way sort of that field has evolved, women have often been sort of treated like passive people rather than active sort of directors in their own births. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times there's a little bit of a learning curve when it comes to informed consent, because you'll see a lot of routine practices and procedures and policies don't necessarily come with informed consent, even though women are definitely owed informed consent.
Let's talk a little bit more about in terms of this informed consent and refusal, the right of autonomy of your body, basically, and decision making. I understand that how maternity field has evolved into this, and it is a tricky situation where you've got the consideration of the mother and the consideration of the baby. And so mm-hmm. sometimes when I speak to you know, whoever about this concept of your right is rights in childbirth, there's always the but, you know, not
what
if it's going to harm the baby. Right. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I think it's important for people to have a little bit of context for the system, which is, and I'm not saying anything new here, a lot of our routine procedures and policies and practices are actually harmful to babies. And a lot of the things that you see families sort of pushing back on are those very things. So families are saying, I've done a bunch of research and I realized that actually this isn't good for the baby. And so I'm going to exercise my right to informed consent and refusal in this instance and say, you know, I'm going to opt for something different, or I'm going to just say no to that thing. So I think it's really important that people understand that, that I think we can assume for the most part that the mother and or the parents are most concerned about the safety of the baby. And if we start with that, you know, it sort of switches the onus from, you know, what the care provider is sort of dictating about it to the care provider empowering the mother to make, you know, to make the choice that's right for her and her baby. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. In terms of putting that into practice, like finding their voice and getting their wishes across, how can the laboring woman and her support team communicate with care providers to make sure they're heard?
Yeah, well, I would say, you know, just to cut to the chase on the whole thing, the number one most important thing is who you pick as your care provider. And I know that, you know, unfortunately, not everyone has a choice or has a lot of choice in that. For those who do have a choice, I would say exercise that choice. Find someone who it's not going to be a struggle, or it's not going to be a fight, or it's not where you're going to have to figure out how to communicate with them. Find someone who already communicates in those terms, and then you can skip this whole, you know, this whole issue. but of course, you can't always predict either, you know, who you get, and you might have different staff members, you know, which, you know, those, you know, nursing staff or aides or techs, and those aren't necessarily things you can plan for. But I think starting with a sense of confidence about what your rights are, and almost like grounded in yourself, I think is really, really important. So that you're not automatically starting out like, on your back foot, that, you know, where you feel like you have to ask permission, because it really should be the other way around. And I think developing that sense of confidence comes from educating yourself, from practicing how you're going to communicate, which I've made a handout about, just to get people sort of, you know, warmed up to that idea. I also, for people who have the time, you know, look into nonviolent communication skills. Mastering Respectful Confrontation is a great book by Joe Weston. And, that just sense of confidence that comes from, you know, being, knowing your rights, feeling like a valued, respected person, with maybe, you know, having a little bit of practice in what exactly you're going to say when you have some questions, or you need a little more time, or you've already decided that that's something that you're going to refuse.
And, you know, it is kind of like weird and bizarre that we're talking about, you know, arming yourself with or learning techniques for nonviolent forms of communication.
Yeah.
As part of a birth skills and tools for your birth, you know?
I know. It seems kind of ridiculous sometimes. But, you know, unfortunately, it's just reality. You know, from a personal perspective, I wasn't used to being treated like without a lot of respect. This sounds like such a ridiculously privileged statement, but it's just true. I just wasn't used to being treated in such a sort of like I was a child. Mm-hmm. And so it caught me off guard, even though I went in really confidently. It was like, oh my goodness, like I don't even know how to talk to these people because I'm so thrown off by, you know, by the way I'm being treated right now. It's just like really bizarre to me. So I don't know. My point is just that you can't prepare too much. You never know how you're going to react, when you're under a little bit of pressure and, you know, you're dealing with some sensations in your body as well.
I mean, with the birth monopoly, you also have all your merchandise that says you're not allowed to not allow me.
And right.
That's such a incredibly to the point essential core of this whole idea of the care providers are allowing you to do this and this and this and this during birth.
Right. And it really is the other way around. Like from a legal rights point of view, from a human rights point of view, from an ethical point of view, it is the mother who gives or does not give permission to anyone else to do anything to her body.
No matter what.
It's not the other way around.
So knowing all of these things, having practiced, I always feel silly role-playing, practicing in front of the mirror. But yeah, there's something about your body doing that muscle memory.
Yeah, well, I think it's really helpful to practice with, you know, have someone pretend to be a nurse or a doctor and, you know, have them get aggressive with you or have them get passive aggressive with you, you know. It is really helpful. It's just one of those things you don't ever think you're going to be in that situation. And then when you are, it can be really uncomfortable. And like you said, it might feel silly, but man, are you going to be grateful for that little bit of muscle memory if you ever actually need it.
Mm-hmm. Tell me if this sounds familiar. You've taken gorgeous photos of your baby or your kids, and then when you want to share them, it is a pain either trying to find the photos or figuring out the group text that they should go to, and then also remembering that, say, Aunt Helen only does email, so you need to send her image separately, Or like in my case, where my husband is a photographer who takes magnificent photos that I rarely actually get to see because they live on his phone or end up scattered in text messages that I can't easily find. Enter the Family Album app, which was created to give parents a secure and easy way to share photos and videos with your loved ones. Basically, it's a personal space for your family's memories without third-party ads or unwanted eyes, and with a bunch of fabulous features. It automatically sorts photos and videos by month, allowing you to swipe back in time and easily see how your child has grown. And you can also order 8 photo prints every month to be delivered to your home. The Family Album app also has unlimited storage. Plus, it's totally free. Yup, no more worrying about running out of space or being bombarded by third-party ads. So, to all the parents out there still trying to use other messaging apps for your kids' photos, level up your family photo game for free and securely with the Family Album photo sharing app. Head over to the App Store today, search Family Album, all in one word, and download the app to start creating your shared photo legacy. With Mother's Day coming up fast, are you looking to get your mom, grandma, or mother figure a gift that they'll actually love? You know, something that is treasured instead of dying out or collecting dust? If so, you need to know about MyLifeInABook.com, which is a service that helps turn their life stories into a beautiful book that can be passed down. How amazing is that? And the process couldn't be easier. Basically, if they can use email, they can create their book. Every week, My Life in a Book will send them an email with a prompt question to get them started. And if they don't like the question, they can easily edit it or change it. We gave a My Life in a Book to a family member that always wants to document all family get-togethers through images. And let me tell you, the process of sending the gift was super simple, even letting us choose the date we wanted the gift to be sent. I'm so looking forward to discovering stories about her youth, her adventures, and the challenges she has overcome. And since My Life in a Book lets you add an image with each answer, she can now share the story that goes along with her many photos. Another great thing is that the answers can be edited at any time before the book is printed, in case she wants to add anything else. Check out MyLifeInABook.com and use the code BIRTHFUL at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use the code BIRTHFUL for 10% off today. So what if you've practiced your phrases and you're like, you know, you've managed many ways of saying no thank you and can we have more time and you are still not being heard? Like if you need to take it to the next level, what suggestions do you have for that?
Well, you know, I would also say something that we haven't talked about very much is the role of the partner. Mm-hmm. You know, we always say that, you know, it's the mother's right and it's the mother's responsibility. But the fact is, that's a really big responsibility to put on someone who's in labor. You know, when she's made it clear that, and, you know, obviously I'm not talking about speaking on behalf of the mother, but, you know, when she's made clear how she feels about something, if she says, for example, you know, no, I don't want to get in bed. I'm going to walk around. And, you know, she's being repeatedly pressured to do something different. It's totally appropriate for the partner to step in and give her that space. You know, the power dynamic, I think, is a little bit different when it comes to, you know, the birthing person versus someone else and the partner versus someone else. You know, it can be really helpful to have a little bit of a united front there and say very respectfully, you know what? She said that she needs to walk around. So I think we're going to let her walk around. Thank you very much. I would say at some point you might want to just say very firmly, I do not consent. I want you to put that in my record. I think that doing that, sometimes can like break the spell of what's going on in there. When you remind someone that, you know what, like this stuff is being documented. there's a bigger world than the little bubble that's happening right in this room right now. You know, I think once you hear the words, "I do not consent," and then, you know, to actually write those words down, "I do not consent," I think is kind of powerful for a person who's trying to get someone to do something that they don't consent to. You know, another thing you can always do, if it's something that, you know, they clearly feel really strongly about, and, you know, a lot of times, frankly, you've got a nurse who, she has a job to do. She's been told, you know, these are the standard practices for, you know, the average woman who comes in, and all she knows is it's her job to get those things done. It can be really helpful to reassure them by saying, "I would be happy to sign a waiver about this thing." You know, I think there's that fear of liability in the back of healthcare providers' heads a lot of times, even when they can't articulate to themselves that is what's motivating them. I've heard about parents, you know, using that sort of tactic successfully. So, another thought is to bring someone else in the room. And again, this is when, you know, a doula or a partner would probably need to help out. I've heard of people asking for the chaplain to come in, which is, you know, sort of like a neutral third person, hopefully, who might bring, you know, a little bit of calm and break some of the tension. Every hospital has a patient advocate or a patient liaison. Some of them advocate more for patients, and some of them advocate more for their employer, which is the hospital. So that's something to bear in mind. But again, you know, when you're sort of out of other options, you know, those are good kind of last resorts. In really extreme situations, you know, I used to run a hotline where women would be basically in the moment and, you know, would call me, and I would have to, you know, help them basically do a legal intervention. And, you know, sometimes we'd have to call the hospital with a lawyer and say, you can't legally force that woman into that C-section, or, you know, something like that. But hopefully our parents aren't going to be getting anywhere close to, you know, needing that level of intervention.
Yeah. And it's so amazing that you were doing that and having that extra support for women in labor, and also baffling and crazy that was needed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. 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 I know. Well, you know, there's such a misunderstanding about the rights of pregnant people. I mean, such a misunderstanding. There's, you know, some places that, like, I swear they've never even heard the term informed consent and refusal. There's just such a variation in awareness and practice around informed consent and refusal.
And so important why we need to keep sharing these things and making sure people understand that they have that right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to talk a lot more about that and hospital policy. So let's talk about that additional layer of, you know, that affects everyone, the nurses, the staff, you, the care providers. Can we talk about, like, where that comes from, what it means, how it affects or interacts with a person's right to informed consent and refusal?
Yeah, I think that is one of the big pain points, is that every hospital has policies and protocols that they, again, there's a variation, that some hospitals view those policies and protocols as guidelines, and some hospitals view them more as requirements. It's a really harmful dynamic, you know, for birthing women to have that idea that anyone can let or allow or not let or not allow them to do anything. But a lot of times when we're told, you know, it's hospital policy, we think, oh, well, then my rights end at hospital policy. The reality is, like, you know, I mentioned a couple of minutes ago about nurses are responsible for policies and protocols. However, your legal rights as a patient are not, less than their obligations to their employer, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So, So your legal rights trump the preferences of the hospital, whether those preferences are, you know, policies or they're just routines or they're protocols or, you know, whatever that is. You know, we're talking about our most basic civil rights here, which is why I always talk about nonviolent communication and mastering respectful confrontation, because it takes some skills to, you know, sort of like directly contradict something that someone's saying to you without escalating the situation. And even more than that, keeping those people on your team, you know, you might need those people's help. There's a good chance, you know, chance that you're going to want, right, their cooperation. And we want everybody to be on the same page.
Yeah, because it's not like you say, well, no, I'm not going to, you know, not eat or drink and then goodbye, I'm out of here. Like, you still have to do the rest of your labor and push for another day.
Right.
So that brings in a great point of that's the great fear, right, of being labeled as difficult or problematic,
yeah,
or being retaliated in some way, that your care deteriorates even more because you've refused
absolutely
to do something. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely, sadly and unfortunately, and it's, you know, something we hate to have to talk about, but, you know, exercising your rights doesn't come with impunity, unfortunately. When you're in a system that is really weighted heavily against you using your rights, it's not as simple as just saying, well, this is what I'm going to do and live with it. And everybody says, okay, great. Awesome. How can we support you next? You know, they're human beings. They have emotions and they have feelings and they have motivations and fears and biases, just like you do and just like I do. And, you know, we have to work with that.
Yeah. And I think what makes it extra hard is that a lot of those policies aren't evidence-based. They aren't necessarily what, you know, is best for mom and labor or baby, like you mentioned earlier.
And that's true. But again, that's probably something that you can figure out much earlier in pregnancy with your care provider and say, you know, what is your, how do you feel about this? Is this a standard practice for you? Is this, have you done this before? Have you done this a lot? Do you get a lot of moms asking for this? How do you feel about it? So you should be able to get a feel for that.
You've got to bring that confidence also into the visits with your care provider, because sometimes it can be intimidating that you have 5 minutes with their.
Right. But that's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Huge.
I mean, you deserve to have your questions answered. That is all there is to it. You are the person who is at the center of that care. And if they don't have time for your questions, then I would really consider that seriously. What's it going to be like when you're giving birth with them? Are they going to have time for you? Are they going to prioritize your comfort and your, you know, providing you with information? You know, that's the last thing I would want to, you know, be in that situation would be in, you know, giving birth and having a care provider refuse to, you know, elaborate on something or refuse to engage with me and just say, well, you know, that's just how we do it. That's not cool.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's not good care.
No.
I remember one woman saying that she said, every time I go to a new practitioner, you know, the first thing I say to them is, listen, I'm one of those patients. So I just want to warn you, I'm one of those patients. I want to know everything and I have lots of questions and I want to talk about everything. And, you know, and she's like very friendly and very approachable about it. But I think that's a really good way to start out, like gauge their reaction to that. I was really lucky when I started with a new OB practice that I like walked in during pregnancy with a piece of paper that had a list of questions. And the doctor immediately said, you know what, just stop right there. I think you might be a really good fit with one of our midwives. I can see you have a lot of questions, and that is really what they're great at. And so she offered, you know, for me to have my next appointment with a midwife instead of with her or one of the other OBs. And that was really awesome. I didn't even know that a nurse midwife or a midwife was an option. And so it was really great that she basically was just like, look, you know, the model I follow, I don't have that much time to answer your questions, but that's important to you. Go to a provider who that's important to them too.
Do you, I know you do a lot of advocacy in general for maternity care. Do you find that the system is improving? Is it changing? What is going on to make it, you know, we've been focusing on in the birth room, but at large, how are things doing?
Wow, that's a really good question. You know, we're definitely way further along than we were before, and we have a really long way to go. But it's really promising, and I'm really excited about it.
And I have seen, you know, like, for example, recommendations and guidelines coming from ACOG, the language change in the past years.
And totally.
The one that came out. Yeah. Talk about that.
Well, I was just going to say, actually, I'm glad you reminded me of that, because earlier I was saying that, you know, there's been more communication with the medical community. So I was with Improving Birth for 3.5 years, and a couple of the things we did there was to communicate directly with ACOG, which I remember, like, at the time that we had the idea, I was just like, why don't we just write ACOG? So, you know, so there have been a couple of instances where we've simply written them letters or even met with them. And that is super cool, because I don't think that's ever happened before. You know, like, I don't think that that ACOG has ever engaged with consumers. Ever, like, mm-hmm. to my knowledge, and I could be wrong about that, but I, you know, I think that's a really big deal. And one of the really eye-opening things, actually, about talking to ACOG is that they have this idea that they're really in touch with consumers, and I definitely would not agree with that statement. So I think it was really great to be able to say, like, actually, guys, like, I think you don't even have a clue what's going on. You know, like, you know, they're an elite group of doctors, and they probably are seeing much more evidence-based practice in the, you know, high-quality, progressive facilities where they are, but can be very disconnected from, you know, the stuff we see in Birmingham, Alabama, or, you know, or even Lexington, Kentucky, where I live.
Yeah. And I think it's, thank you for going and talking to ACOG. And I also think it, communication and awareness, I think the media awareness, the mistreatment in maternity care that's been labeled, you know, quote unquote, obstetric violence, having that be something that's being discussed in the media or in headlines.
Well, yeah. And like, that didn't happen by accident. You know, like, I led media strategy at Improving Birth for the years that I was there. And that was, like, one of our top goals, was getting the maternity care crisis in media. And then I made it my personal goal about obstetric violence. And it's really cool to look back and see that now we're talking about things that were, like, not even mentioned 5 years ago. Like, we're not even in the media. Are absolutely in the media. And and so, you know, I think it's raising a lot of awareness and hopefully paving the road for a much bigger conversation.
Huge. And people do need to hear these stories. And I encourage listeners to do a Google search for obstetric violence so they can see, you know, what that's about. Like, just as people don't sometimes know that they have those choices to, and from some things as simple as you wear your own clothes, you know, that you don't have to wear the gown.
All those little ways that you can sort of assert your humanity.
and show that you're not, like, you're not a patient. You're just a woman in labor. You're not sick.
Right? And you're not, you know, you're not like a gadget or a widget on an assembly line, you know, that you are an individual and you expect individualized care.
And listeners, moms need to, like, you know, safeguard your environment, safeguard your birth, like, make sure your voice is heard.
You know what? You know, I say, be selfish. This is the one time in your life when you need to give yourself permission to be totally selfish. Be catered to. You deserve to be catered to. And if that's a, if that's like a hard thing to swallow, or a hard, you know, a hard way to carry yourself, remember that you are protecting your baby. So it's a big responsibility. And, you know, I think we've got to be real clear about that and really embrace that responsibility. It's, I do have the right to be selfish on behalf of my baby. I do. Because yeah. You know what? You're going to have to be for the rest of your life. You Indeed. Might as well start now.
Absolutely. Know your rights. Yes. Kristen, thank you so, so much for this fantastic talk. You've been listening to a Best of Birthful episode. To listen to the original longer version of this episode, click on the link in the show notes. And there are many more where this came from. Look for episodes with the words Best of Birthful in the title to continue your deep dive to inform your intuition. You can find the in-depth show notes for this episode at birthful.com. You can also connect with us directly on Instagram. We're at Birthful Podcast. Birthful was created by me, Adriana Lozada, and is a production of La Antigua Williams & Co. The show's senior producer is Paulina Velasco. Virginia Lora is the managing producer. Cedric Wilson is our lead producer. Ali Kiltz contributed to the production of the Best of Birthful series. Thank you for listening to and sharing Birthful. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, and everywhere you listen. Come back every week for more ways to inform your intuition.